Okay, well, let's get started. Thank you for coming. We're going to talk today about Uzbekistan's elections and the future of Uzbekistan. And we have with us Alisher Sadiq, the head of our Uzbek service, and Noah Tucker of the Uzbek service, and Bruce Panier, our expert on Central Asia. We will talk a little while among ourselves, and then as many people who want to ask questions, you're all welcome to, of course. Если будет вопросы по-русски, пожалуйста. So we now have a president-elect in Uzbekistan, Shavkat Mirziyayev, who was prime minister since 2003 and now is president, replacing Islam Karimov, who died on September 2nd at the age of 78. So the new president, Mirziyayev, was elected by a majority of 88.6%. Which sounds like an old-style, Soviet-style election. But on the other hand, there have been some indications that maybe something is changing in Uzbekistan. So that's what we want to talk about today. So I'm going to ask each member of our panel to talk for just 2 or 3 minutes about what their impressions are of the election and Uzbekistan's future, and then we'll talk among ourselves and hope that as many of you as possible will join in. So you want to start, Alisher?
Mm-hmm. I'll just recap, you know, what happened during these 3 month period since Karimov's death, you know, so you have better idea where Uzbekistan is probably moving. So it's Mirziyayev's third month in power. So he had a funeral ceremony. From that point, we knew, or we had a very good sort of clue that he will be replacing Karimov as president. So as we know, in all communist style, whoever leads the funeral ceremony later become the leaders. Then he was appointed as acting president in violation of constitution, because constitution would provide the clause that only the chairman of Senate can become an acting president. So that they disregarded this part. He immediately proposed anti-corruption legislation. It's still in progress. Businesses were relieved from administrative pressure and bribe extortion. The law on protection of businesses was immediately approved. Business community is pretty happy at this point. He improved accountability by establishing virtual hotlines. People can address their problems directly to Prime Minister and hope that problems would be resolved. It's also an ongoing process. He released at least 2 political prisoners. Many more remain in prison. So there's a hope that the Karimov's political prisoners will be released, as Mirziyayev would have nothing to do with them. He allowed other member of his cabinet to be a little bit more public. So they kind of speak, they also appear in front of people, they talk about democracy. For instance, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs even said, we will not have any development if we don't start political reforms. So it's a big kind of statement that would be punished under Karimov's regime if someone would just say things like this. So he declared the continuation of fight against extremism in Uzbekistan. So he said we will be still staunch kind of fighters against any Islamism and extremism. He made a couple of pro-Russian moves. He promised first official visit as a president to Russia. He met Lukoil's chief owner, Alek Perov, allowed to expand Lukoil's business in Uzbekistan. He voted against resolution condemning Russia for Crimea politics. Before, Uzbek's votes in UN never came against US or Israel. So now it's the first time they voted not in line with US or Israel. Our neighbors, Tajikistan, relations with Tajikistan improved, border crossing became more easy, not opposing the construction of Rogun Dam, also promised resumption of flights. Kyrgyzstan resolving border disputes, opening border for crossing, considering the Kyrgyz proposal of jointly construct Khambarata Dam. On Turkey, he meets with Turkey President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Everybody knows that Uzbekistan had very bad relations with Turkey over many years. But now he meets Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan said he wanted to open a new chapter of Uzbek-Turkish relations, agreed to boost economic cooperation. Actually, Uzbekistan offered one region for Turkey to develop, and they relieved him from taxes, everything. So it's quite a good offer. He's building his new cabinet, but all of them were old people. So Rustam Azimov, he oversees finances, economy, trade, and investment. Ulugbek Razakulov also his very close AD. So he's also controlling regions, economy partially. Abdullah Oripov, telecommunications, culture, sports, these things. Rustam Inayatov, security, counterterrorism, and the rest of security issues. So as president-elect, he started major tourism reforms by lifting visas for 27 countries. He proposed direct elections of mayors, issues that are not addressed. He never spoke about freedom of media, never talked about foreign NGOs, Human Rights Watch, Freedom House. They were kicked by Karimov after 2005 Andijan events. He never talked about political reforms, like opposition or this kind of stuff. And the issue of Gulnara Karimova, who the daughter of President Karimov, is still not resolved. She's under home arrest, and the fate of family is unclear. Main challenges: lack of investments, currency convertibility because of reforms of cotton industry, building up country's energy capabilities, lack of gas, electricity, decaying in infrastructure as general. So this is main points.
And what agrarian reforms, the property of cotton fields, nothing?
No, I mean, this remains as a big challenge. So cotton industry as a whole, so he could not change it overnight. So they had to continue this for some time, but I don't know how they will think around it at this point.
Noah, you want to pick up there?
Sure. I want to take just one issue from all of the things that we have to look at, and this is the question of whether or not Uzbekistan will remain closed or Uzbekistan will begin to open. Because the country has become, in a sort of slow way, almost, over the past 15, 16 years, the country has gone from being a really open hub of Central Asia, where, it's almost hard to believe now that Tashkent was once the location of most of the big international organizations, media organizations, everything really happened in Tashkent. And had enormous international investment and participation in the international economy throughout the 1990s and into the early 2000s. And then suddenly those things, slowly, those things began to change to the point that it became one of the more closed countries on earth, actually, in the later period of sort of the Karimov presidency. And we look at this oftentimes from a political angle, because that's what we like to talk about in part, and because that's certainly part of our mission. But there's another way to look at this, and that's from the angle of political economy. There was another thing, aside from this desire for security and control over politics, which was certainly something that was driving Karimov, there's an argument to be made that the logic of Uzbekistan's political economy also drove this closeness, because the political economy in Uzbekistan developed in such a way that the state became the focus of the entire economy, because those who were in power, the elite who rose to the top and survived sort of the competitions of the 1990s, eventually used the state apparatus to take really total control over the economy. And by the early 2000s, they began to use that state control that they had developed, this full control of state resources, to eat the pie, so to speak. But the pie was the economic pie, if we look at it as a pie or a cake, or if you want to say a pie, had developed with all this international investment and openness. And then as a certain number of elites reached kind of a critical mass of control over the country, they turned inward and began to consume all of this. And as a result, the pie became smaller and smaller and smaller as international investors dropped away, as more of them were expropriated of the investments that they made, as people were cut out of the country, and it became increasingly unattractive for them to try to participate. Currency convertibility is one of those serious issues. But the currency issue is also part of the pie, because this lack of currency convertibility has given some people who are in control of the currency black markets, the ability to assure their own control over this massive black market currency convertibility industry. But that ends up being bad for everyone else. And so the thing that I want to suggest is that as Uzbekistan faces this question now, to open or to remain closed, it's the logic of this political economy that actually will push it towards openness, because they've eaten the entire pie at this point. The elites that are in power have divided up everything that they can. They've cut out as many of their competitors as they can. And now we see the whole economy beginning to creak at the edges. Long lines for gasoline, persistent shortages of hard currency, shortages of electricity, shortages of gas. And the population becomes larger, and so the demand for these things increase really each year as the population grows. But the supply is not increasing because the pie is already set. And so if we just look at one issue, the availability of hard currency that all of these elites need if they want to spend their holidays in Spain or buy new mansions in Crimea or, you know, wherever it is. If they want to continue to enjoy the lifestyles that they have, they can't do it with an unconvertible currency. They can't do it with profits that they make in SUM. So they have to have more hard currency. And it's just not going to happen. None of these problems are going to be solved. The economy will not grow if they don't adjust this course and allow more openness and allow some sort of new, if they don't dump some new ingredients into the pie, there's nothing left for them anymore. So apart from politics, apart from security issues, or apart from their ability to keep continual control of things, it's no longer actually in their interest to live in an economy, and in a political economy that's as closed as this one has become. And so I actually am optimistic about the openness issue. I'm optimistic about the commitment to opening up tourism and opening up foreign investment, not because I believe Mirziyoyev is at heart a true reformer or anyone else has had a real change of heart in the system, but because it actually has become in their own economic advantage to do this. And they really don't have a lot of other options at this point.
All right. For once, I get the happy news when talking about Uzbekistan, because I'm going to try to give you an idea of what this means to the neighbors that they got a new guy. Uzbekistan was the first one to actually recognize its borders, and I know this from personal experience. When the Soviet Union fell apart in late 1991, and I got there in 1992, you could drive from one country right into another and never know that you'd ever passed into another country at all. By the end of 1992, Uzbekistan knew that it was a sovereign nation and started establishing border posts in the east at first. But that was what sparked everyone to create their own border posts, and it was the beginning of Uzbekistan's isolation. All of a sudden, I couldn't just go into Uzbekistan. I had to be stopped and talk to people. But that was me. For the neighbors, it was much worse because it started to complicate transport and trade routes in the region. All of a sudden, Uzbekistan, in the case of Tajikistan, for instance, blocked the train that was going through northern Tajikistan and decided they were going to stop that at least. Eventually, they did away with it entirely. The bus communications lines that went from eastern Uzbekistan through northern Tajikistan were canceled by the late summer of 1992 already. This, as you can imagine, we don't need a map. I'm sure you're all familiar, but Uzbekistan is bordered by all these countries, so it is the middle of the region. And when Uzbekistan becomes blocked to the other ones, it complicates everything, your passage from one place to another, not only in the road network, but transmission of electricity, gas, things like this. Everything gets complicated all of a sudden. This evolved into a much worse problem by the end of the 1990s, where we saw that not only did Uzbekistan have border guards and posts all over its border, but with the arrival of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan in 1999, the Uzbek government decided they were going to put landmines along the border with Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, which are still there. And the Uzbek government has refused repeatedly to provide maps of where these things are, leaving the Tajik and Kyrgyz governments to do what they can to try to demine the border.
They have maps?
Well, I mean,
they don't have.
I don't know anymore, to tell you the truth, and I think a lot of them were dispersed by helicopter anyway, so I'm not sure they know exactly where some of these things are. But so the once open borders ended up being an area where shootings were frequent. People get wounded every, particularly in the east along the Kyrgyz and Tajik border. People get wounded every year. Several people get killed every year. It's not just the east. It's happened along the Kazakh border. It's happened along the Turkmen border too. Now, as I said, because of this Uzbekistan's border control and the fact that they would not allow free passage, we have long lines at the border. Sometimes the border is not open at all. It's forced countries to reroute their own traffic to get to places. Every single country around Uzbekistan has had to build its own railway lines to avoid going through Uzbekistan's territory. Most of these countries don't have this kind of money, so it's a big financial burden for them to all of a sudden build a railroad track that goes way over and then comes up Kyrgyzstan to Kazakhstan. You know, Turkmenistan had to build its route to go internally. So
Uzbekistan also had to build.
Yeah, and Uzbekistan, of course, has done its own. The Pap-Angren rail line was built specifically so that they wouldn't have to go through Tajik territory anymore. So it's been a big problem for everyone. Okay, the Tajik and Kyrgyz relationships with Uzbekistan were probably the worst. Now, we'll go from there. Karimov dies. When Karimov is finally declared dead, there are Uzbek troops on Kyrgyz territory at Ungar 2. It's a television rail relay station that belongs. It's in Kyrgyz territory. But because of a dispute over water rights from a nearby reservoir, Uzbek troops have occupied that at least three times in the last few years. And in this last case, they actually held the staff of the relay station hostage. I don't know. I can't think of another way to say it. Prisoner, hostage, whatever. So Mirziyoyev comes to power, and one of the first things he does is to get the troops out of Kyrgyz territory, which diffused the tensions there. By the end of September, all of a sudden we hear that Uzbekistan is holding demarcation talks, which have been long stalled with every single country in the region. They held them with Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, and also at the same time, Tajik-Kyrgyz or Uzbek relations not being good, Rahman did go to the funeral, but by the end of the month, Mirziyoyev had sent his foreign minister to Tajikistan to start talking about improving relations, and that was the first time we get the clue, as Ali Shear mentioned, about the Rogun Dam. That was the first time we see that the conversation wasn't specifically about Rogun Dam, it was about rational use of water, which was a little bit of a signal that they're easing their policy on that, which is vital to Tajikistan because hydropower is ultimately all they got for power. But this has been held up by Uzbekistan. So then by the end of September, we hear that they're holding demarcation talks with Kazakhstan, which started in 2002. And they're almost done now already. They started demarcation talks again with Kyrgyzstan, which have been going on practically forever. About half of the disputed areas are now resolved, and they said they were agreed. Now, I'm still not sure what that means on the ground, because if you've ever traveled in southern Kyrgyzstan by the Uzbek border, you see that the fence goes and then juts out 2 kilometers that way and then comes winding back by the road again. It's very haphazard and kind of like a jigsaw puzzle or something down there. But for what it's worth, at least they say they've agreed on about half the places on that. As a move of a confidence-building measure, Uzbek officials in southern or in the eastern part of Uzbekistan invite Kyrgyz officials to come over and have a festival in Andijan, where they talk about Kyrgyz-Uzbek friendship. A reciprocal visit is made to Osh in Kyrgyzstan at the end of October. Also in October, an unofficial Uzbek business delegation goes and visits Tajikistan. Strikes up a good conversation, lots of talk about Uzbek, Tajik brotherhood and things going way back. And like I said, in the Kazakh case, their border is practically resolved. Turkmen-Uzbek relations have been good since Niyazov died in 2006. They've gradually improved, but Uzbekistan certainly didn't forget about Turkmenistan, and there's been a lot of reports about him, Mirziyoyev and Berdimuhamedov talking with each other. Berdimuhamedov obviously extended a visit, an official invitation to come and visit Turkmenistan, as has pretty much everyone. I don't think Atambayev extended an invitation yet, but he is going to Uzbekistan very soon to pay his respects at the gravesite of Karimov, who was someone who was not Atambayev's friend. There's no doubt about it. But so, of course, for Atambayev, this is good news, too. So for the whole region, this plug in trade and distribution of energy and stuff is now being, it looks like it's about to be removed. So it's a huge event for the neighbors. Even Afghanistan, Mirziyoyev hasn't forgot about them too. When they had this Organization of the Islamic Conference summit in Tashkent, Mirziyoyev made a big point of saying, we're sending our foreign ministry delegation to Kabul. We're going to talk about greater cooperation. So for the first time, and again, I haven't been on the ground since Mirziyoyev's come to power. I know that there are still problems that the Kyrgyz have transiting, at least as far as cargo, transiting Uzbek territory by vehicle. Apparently, they still have to rent vehicles that have Russian license plates to enter Uzbek territory. But for what it's worth, Uzbekistan said they're going to open up the railway traffic to Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, fix the Anzug railway line, which was mysteriously destroyed a few years ago. But they said they're going to fix that, and so that'll be going back into Tajikistan. I do not know what their policy is going to be entirely toward Ragoon, but I know that was part of the reason the Anzug railway got blown up, was because they didn't want goods, construction material from Iran transiting Uzbek territory and getting to Tajikistan. So if they fix that railway and allow construction material to go from Iran all the way into Tajikistan, of course, this is nothing but good news for Tajikistan and its people. So there's for the first time really since 1992, there's a lot of hope from the neighbors that maybe they have a neighbor in Uzbekistan that they can deal with and have a legitimate partnership with and not a bully that dictates the terms of entering their country or exiting their country for that fact.
All right, so when we're talking, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Excuse me. Do you know anything about the personal relationship between Rahman and Mirziyoyev?
Yeah, it's good, actually. They seem to have got along. You know, it meant a lot also symbolically that Rahman went to the funeral. I mean, he wasn't a good friend of Karimov either.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that was celebration more than mourning. That's true. But it'll be the same when Atambayev goes. I mean, I think he's going just to laugh and, you know, say good, the old guy's gone. He was the biggest problem. They seem to get along pretty good. Which is, again, nothing but good news for certainly Tajik-Uzbek relations, but for the region, too, that they'd be able to get across.
Well, since we're talking about foreign relations, let's talk about relations a little bit more with Russia and China and the United States. So Alisher pointed out that there have been contacts with Lukoil, trip to Moscow coming up, conversations with Lukoil. Apparently, Lukoil's interested in opening gasoline stations across Uzbekistan. At the same time, I don't think Uzbekistan traditionally has been very interested in any kind of defensive alliances with anybody, including Russia, or economic blocks led by Russia. The relationship with China has been kind of one-sided about exporting resources to China. And then the United States seems sort of like a black hole. So why don't you talk a little bit about what you see as the prospects for relations with the United States and China and Russia?
So probably I can take this one. So with Russia, it's very kind of Mirziyoyev's allegedly is very close to Russian establishment. So his son-in-law, Oybek, he has very close contacts among Russian businessmen. So also Lukoil, we're actually investigating, but there is something deeper with Lukoil and Mirziyoyev. So from the own from the previous kind of setting. So on economy part, I think they will push more for cooperation with Russia. But there is migrants issue. So millions of migrants from Uzbekistan, they work in Russia. So how that will be resolved? Uzbekistan is suffering very much due to the lack of remittances from Russia. For the past 2 years, due to Russian economic crisis, the money from migrants, you know, really decreased. So that's why I think the talks between Putin and Mirziyoyev could go around this migrant issue. And probably for Moscow, it was one of the thing they used to play all the time. You know, they always kind of blackmail Uzbekistan to expel all the migrants in case you don't sort of do, you know, if you're not in favor of Russia. So that was a pressure for Uzbekistan. With Russia, there is a good prospect for future cooperation, and it's not considered negative by people. So it's not like kind of something that would be like negatively, you know, perceived. If you say, you know, we will open up with Russia, everybody say, oh, it's very good. But there is a huge concern of this political kind of Kremlin's political agenda, whether closeness with Russia will create this kind of political pressure by Putin on the new Uzbek regime. So with U.S., again, this is something that was never addressed yet by Mirziyayev, so they don't have, I think, clear policy now. They don't even talked about, they haven't talked about European Union as well. And on China, the cooperation is, again, is based on the exports of Uzbek gas. So they say that the gas, that the profits of gas increased 60% for the past year from the Chinese export, meaning that, but this is bad news for Uzbekistan, you know, because it means that people got less gas actually for their own local domestic consumption, and you know,
so limited amount.
Yeah, so if they continue cooperation, any cooperation with China on resources is a bad news internally, because they consider, you know, our gas will go for Chinese consumption, and the money from that purchase, it's one of the darkest area. It's ultimately untransparent where the profits go, sort of for cotton, from gas, from uranium, from gold. So that's the part which is very kind of dark for Uzbeks. You know, we don't know how eventually people.
And in addition to that question, Uzbekistan was the main obstacle for integration of Central Asia, and Karimov built a system which is not easy to break, right? So far, the steps that he took basically for internal use and give some signals to outside world. But we don't know anything about geopolitical orientation of Uzbekistan. You know, Karimov was playing between Russia and America and European Union. And Mirziyayev is a man of this system. Do we have any clue how he would play with this? Because they don't, they without any desire, Central Asian countries are a small gaika of this geopolitical big game in Central Asia.
So as Noah said, for them, the major problem is economy now. They have to fix it. So that's why Mirziyayev, whenever he says about cooperation, he says, if it is in economic interest, we're going to do it. Sort of, he's sort of, whoever gives money, so he's ready to cooperate, basically. So if that will be Russia, China. So they want to fix economy at this point. So if United States can offer something, investments, that would immediately open way for them. So they're now looking out for actually cash machine, you know. So they don't need this geopolitical games. I think Karimov's one of the biggest mistakes is thinking that he's playing geopolitical games. You know, it's like he thinks he's a big player, but it never worked out. You know, for
Can I pick up on just a couple things real quick before you got the question? Just to expand a little bit, it's not only Lukoil, it's also Gazprom. Uzbekistan, right after Mirziyayev got in, he sent the head of Uzbek Neftegaz to speak with Miller in Alexei Miller in Moscow. And that led to an agreement of like bumping up the amount of gas they would import from Uzbekistan. But at the same time, this is one of those things where it sounds like it suits Uzbekistan's interests really well, and you look and say, well, what does Russia get out of it? Well, that's easy, because they're playing a game with Turkmenistan too, where they cut Turkmenistan off and started buying Uzbek gas. So this is a way for Moscow to manipulate the relationships within the region too. Russia gets something out of this, because now they can say, we don't need your gas, Turkmenistan, unless you're willing to cut a better deal for us, which we assume means lower prices through Russian pipelines. So Moscow gets something out of that. Now, in terms of China, China's got this One Belt, One Road thing going, too. And for the reasons I just said regionally were true for, you know, that Uzbekistan could block traffic there, China's aware of this, too. And to some extent, they actually have unblocked it a little bit. The three pipelines coming out of Turkmenistan, the gas pipelines going to China, were a sign that China can unblock some of this stuff there, because it does go through Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and go into China. So China will certainly want Uzbekistan to be more regionally integrated, because it suits Chinese purposes that there's free routes back and forth as part of their grand strategy of one belt, one road.
But there is actually nothing except from gas that the region can offer to China. There's nothing, absolutely. just
oil and metals.
Just gas, you know. So that's why Chinese sort of they just taking contract construction, building contracts, investments, but they don't look at it as a big profit from the region, even market wise. So they don't consider it as a big region from where you can profit. They just take resources. That was the main kind of strategy. And regarding Afghanistan, Mirziyayev did travel to Termiz, this border area with Afghanistan, and he visited this biggest center, logistics center, and he said that this logistics center will be the sample for other centers that are to be built in the border areas with all these countries, and that they will start huge trade with Afghanistan. I don't know, but this is what was the promise. And they actually built this huge hub for this.
Yeah, of all these things, of what was he has been doing since he came, replaced Karimov, they sound too good to be true for Uzbekistan for 27 years. And as Sojina pointed out, he's the man of the system. He's apprentice of Karimov's apprentice, basically, right? And we, as Noah said, we all noted, observed those kind of things, like attracting investments in the beginning of Karimov era. And what are the risks that we are going to have Karimov 2.0 from all the beginning?
I think, and I have also the outsiders can ask a question outside of. So my question is, I still don't understand what happened with this guy Mirziyayev. How he's been, how he's been elected or whatever. How he won this battle to become president. Do you think that this Russian billionaire Usmanov had a role in this, or Russia had a role in this at all? Do you think that something happened that changed the course?
Russia wants us to believe that they had a role in it. Russia really wants everyone to believe that they have a lever over Mirziyoyev through Usmanov or through other things. In fact, before Karimov was even officially dead, before he was cold in the ground, long before it, the Russian media was going wild about how Mirziyoyev was the one to. It was unanimous. There was all the experts, the expert of the day, who yesterday was an expert on China, and the day before was an expert on Armenia, and the day before was an expert on the Middle East. You know, they come and they present themselves as. They even invented a new word in the Russian press: Uzbekolog.
Say Russia
and Mirziyoyev, they want to convey this sense that they have some sort of lever over Mirziyoyev, but I think the utter lack of competition that we had, this sort of magical silent gliding, across the Constitution and into power and into the presidency with the support of all of the other political parties, and everything else, shows us actually
a surprise, right?
No, not at all. It was so. What we see there actually is that the Mirziyoyev is a consensus candidate inside the system. No one felt threatened. None of the other interests inside the country felt at all threatened by Mirziyoyev taking power, partly because, he's probably been running the country for the last 5 or 6 years, as Karimov has sort of faded into the back. Yeah, so that's another reason why, as from himself, from any sort of personal impetus, we don't really buy this idea that he's a reformer. Just like,
and then why we're so optimistic that things will go?
That's what
I'm saying. If there's no surprise if he's a guy of Karimov, then why?
He's saying things that we haven't heard for 10 or 15 years coming out of Uzbekistan.
No, you're absolutely right on the thing that we may be talking about Karimov 2.0, but it's the question of after 5 years from now,
Right.
So these guys, they're all good the first 5 years, the first terms. You know, at this point, we don't see that he is wanted to become a Karimov. He says, it's very funny, he says, we're going to continue Karimov's policy on stage. But what he does is discontinuing Karimov's policy. You know, wherever he goes, he discontinues what was previously, you know, established. When Karimov closed, he opens. Where Karimov banned, he even singers whom Karimov banned, he allowed them to sing again, sort of.
But he might ban others, right?
He will, and I think that's what we would expect to see. He has, all he's done is pulled back some of Karimov's eccentricities, the things, his excesses, the places where the system went too far under him. He's normalizing a little bit. We're not seeing some brand new country. We're still not even getting remotely back to the place where Uzbekistan was in 2003 under Karimov. You know, we're peeling back just a little bit slowly. But I think one of the reasons to be sort of pessimistic about things is while you see, whenever you open up the economy, okay, you generate maybe a new, you generate potentially a new set of elites. You widen the pie a little bit more, and more people are able to take a share of it. And then what happens when they want some political say to go along with their economic power? And then probably what happens is the system circles back on itself,
yeah,
and does it again. Only this time, you're plus 25 years of decay from the Soviet era infrastructure and everything else. You've burned so many of your bridges, for example, with the United States. You know, we talk about Russia and China, nobody mentions all the American investment that's going to be happy to rush in, or the European investment that's going to be happy to rush in. It's probably not going to happen. I mean, after what happened to Newmont and the difficult experiences even that Chevrolet has had, they've been GM, who have lasted longer than anyone else, but this is still not a particularly lucrative operation for them. And so I think there are consequences for the things that have happened before. And even if we have an economic opening, I'm very pessimistic that we see much of a civil or political or religious opening anytime in the near future, because that's not in the interest of anyone.
It's hard to believe that Tashkent was always for years, for decades, to the cultural and academic center in civilization. Best professors, best universities, best students from our countries went to study in Tashkent to do their doctoral studies, etc. So it's hard to believe that society was so passive all these years.
Mm-hmm.
We have a country where one man decides everything, at least with Karimov. And now, will it continue or change? It depends on society. Do you see any signs of, I don't know, some intelligentsia or some young people nowadays, with internet, social networks and everything, do you see any part of society could generate at least some ideas to make some changes? What do you think?
Oh, that's a good one. Under Karimov, the general thinking was there could be nothing worse than Karimov. So whoever comes, it's going to be better. And that's, the guy was working 13 years under Karimov. So this guy, if he was not killed all these years, so he's either very smart or I don't know what. We didn't know about his family even, you know, that he had family, you know, who is his wife or kids, who are there. And they appeared for the first time in public. So for us, it's kind of a
good sign.
Yeah. But he has very good opportunity to learn by Karimov's mistakes and also try to not to repeat them. Actually, he could be the best qualified person at this point to run the country. And again, I can just only repeat that he did not reveal any political plans, you know, like how he wants to. He is from Uzbekistan's Liberal Democratic Party, you know, like means if they want to kind of do some reforms, it should be like democratic and liberal reforms we should expect.
That's,
yeah,
just liberals one in one
point. Yeah, but at the same time, the guy spent most of his time in the cotton fields. That is where his expertise on many issues, of on international issues. The rumors around Alisher Usmanov's, you know, Russian oligarchs staying around and coming to Uzbekistan with his advisors, some of sources inside Uzbekistan also confirmed that indeed they brought a good PR team for Mirziyayev, a good expertise on economic reforms, that they looked into Uzbek economy a little. So we just hope that Mirziyayev will be the guy, you know, who would just kind of delegate these things that he doesn't know anything about to these teams, you know, to advisors. So that's why it will very much depend on how he will surround himself, you know, with what expertise at this point.
I think to get to your question, that's another thing that sort of takes us away from optimism, because after you have so many years of steady decay, especially like in the education sector, where you'll see, I would say in this case, Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan are sort of opposite cases this way, where, you know, Bishkek is like the city of universities, almost like Boston. You know, there's been such an openness to investment in education. Now there's a whole other question about what they do with those young people then once they're educated. But Uzbekistan really did sort of the opposite, and I think this is another thing that pushes, that may force the country back towards openness, because there's this whole generation of young, well-educated people, some of whom are sitting in this room, who had to leave because there was nothing left for them there, and those who are educated under the system that was left are not trained to international standards. So, you know, there will probably be, you know, serious problems in the next few years in terms of like the quality of healthcare in Uzbekistan. It's already so bad, and as the last generation of people trained under the Soviet system leave, you know, retire, and so many other trained professionals have left the country. You know, you even back when I was living there in the early and mid 2000s, it was terrifying. Sort of, if you had a medical emergency and you were to go into surgery, because you never know if the person who's going to operate on you actually attended their classes, or if they just paid for their diploma, and that's the sort of thing that has really long term consequences. And if it's not if there's not an opening, if they're not willing to bring back almost sort of a whole lost generation of young people who were educated in other places and allow them to come back to the country and incentivize that somehow, then once you hit the generation where the Soviet-trained people finally leave or have to retire, then things might not go so well.
If I could just jump in real quick and mention two things, too, because it gets to both your points about optimism and what might happen in the country. There's two things always worth remembering, two moments worth remembering. One, he became acting president through unconstitutional means. He went right around the Constitution. And two, this last election was just a classic Uzbek election. So as much as you want to think that maybe things will change for the better, he got in unconstitutionally, and he just held he was elected in a horrible election. So.
Good question.
I have an additional question on the regional integration. Before the election, an Uzbek official from the foreign minister made clear that Uzbekistan doesn't have any intention to join the Eurasian Economic Union, which is dominated by Russia. And we know that Uzbekistan left twice the organization, CSTO, yes? Do we know anything about Uzbek leadership plan on regional organization? I'm just wondering whether Russia would force Uzbek leaders to join its organization.
Eurasian Economic Union. Like the one.
Again, the statement that they're doing, they say it's not profitable at this point to join Eurasia Union. So they look at...
Sure, I'm sorry, did he actually said something about the Eurasian economy?
They said it's not, how do you say, at this point, невыгодно, how do you say, like,
yeah,
not advantageous.
Yeah. So they look at Kyrgyz experience. They say, they think it's horrible. You know, the custom union. Yeah. So that's why they look at issues from this perspective now. But sooner or later, it will come to the point with CSTO, you know, especially that they will be just said, you know, you have to.
Well,
I don't know how.
You know, there is an opening for them to play balance with the United States, because inside the U.S. government, the only institution that's consistently willing to work with Uzbekistan is the Defense Department. And, you know, in a way, they're sort of at the worst of things. You know, the Defense Department was really the only sort of functioning diplomatic relationship that we had with Uzbekistan. So, you know, we could, as Americans, we can sort of be glad for that, I guess, that at least we had that avenue of communication that was left. And there is strong support inside the defense sector to continue to cooperate with Uzbekistan, and there's strong interest in balancing Russian advances in the region. So I actually can't see them forced into joining the CSTO. And at this point, Uzbekistan has been able to successfully get an agreement with Russia to conduct bilateral negotiations on things like fruit and vegetable export imports and gas and, you know, all of these other things. Russia is so far not pushing them as hard as they push Kyrgyzstan or have tried to push Tajikistan. And maybe it's because they haven't been able to force Tajikistan to join yet. They have so much leverage over Tajikistan, but still have not been able to force them to join. So
it depends on the circumstances. Like,
yeah.
Kaimov rejoined CSTO after Andijan arrived.
Right.
It will depend on, and Mirziyayev will continue.
Yeah.
So last week they
question from the news. Just to change the topic.
Sure.
The area is facing a greater risk of extremism, tourism. Uzbekistan has this Islamic looming on Uzbekistan. Yes, but Tahrir is there. The some of the INU is now turning to IS. You all know that there are camps in Afghanistan. So, but in the past, as we have observed, the Uzbekistan counterterrorism policy was being, to a greater extent, manipulated by Russians. It was at their camp, for example, at the peak of the counterterrorism efforts of NATO and US, they closed Kashihan Abad, followed by closure of Manaus. So how the new Uzbek government will deal with the counterterrorism policy? Will it still be manipulated by Russia, or will they go for a greater cooperation with the international community with ongoing efforts of counterterrorism in Afghanistan and in the region? How do you?
Well, I'll just briefly say, as Ali Shir mentioned, that you know, they said that they wouldn't, obviously they're not going to change their policy toward potential militants and stuff. We're fortunate to have one of the leading authorities on Central Asian militants sitting here in the room, so I will defer to Noah, who knows far more about these things than I do.
I mean, what they said, we will not have a military base in Uzbekistan, neither Russian nor American. This is like full stop. It's even written in the foreign policy doctrine.
But
yeah, they allowed it. Yeah, after that, they sort of put it in the doctrine. They also said, we will not join any political military organizations, such as CSTO or NATO. So this is like their kind of a fundamental thinking.
So do you think that the closure of Kashihan Abad was not because of the pressure of Russia?
No, it had nothing to do with Russia. They were angry at the United States for Andijan. Is that, well... That, and we also were about 6 months behind on our payments for K2, and so it was not there were a lot of other things happening, but no, it was not, the Russians were not as concerned about it back in 2004 2005. Russia, the as Manas stayed open more and more years, and the more times that we renewed that lease agreement, Russia became increasingly upset about that and really did do all sorts of things to try to push us out of Kyrgyzstan, hiring protesters and, you know, things like this. There wasn't really anything like that for Uzbekistan. It was it functioned well. There wasn't really a lot of Russian opposition to it. Everything ran fairly smoothly, except for our problems, disagreements over the payments until Andijan. And then at that point, they said, you're out of here. And it wasn't just Karshikhanabad, but just about every American and international organization that was headquartered in Tashkent was slowly shuttered or kicked out or everything else.
But the reason to kick out Americans was ecological reasons.
Yeah.
Because American planes were just destroying ecology.
Yeah.
There are some things that are happening that like may create maybe false illusion about like openness in the society. But what about the international organizations' headquarters? Yeah. How about media? What kind of connections or cooperation might be with international media organizations? I recently heard something about BBC maybe planning to open like talks again with Tashkent. How there might be the future of RFRL in the Uzbekistan maybe?
Is planning to go to Tashkent next week.
Is that true?
No. Yeah, again, as I said, this is the area where we never heard of a new leadership anything. So we know that BBC is in talk with the Uzbek state television, but they in talk as a general, as a BBC, not as a sort of Uzbek service, you know, as a kind of particular branch of BBC. And we know that BBC's monitoring was working all these years, you know, throughout all these years. And so Russian media, they have very good positioning, so they have no problems, and it's very easy to work as Russian media in Uzbekistan. For instance, during the elections, as I mentioned, ORT, like first Russian channel, said that it's unpredictable elections, absolutely democratic, you know. So keep saying those things, and it's very easy, you know. Whoever is ready to say such things, it's tomorrow you can go and start working. But they have experience with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I think it's also, they have some sort of decisions made over these years. It's uncontrollable. So whenever they open for Radio Free Europe, it still starts kind of saying things that they don't like. So that's why for them, asking us to come back after all these years would be maybe good, because it's the only way to control us at this point. Because of technology, because we were like for so long outside Uzbekistan, and we developed all these networks, we cover it as we're there with all the means, you know, technological means. So for them, the only way to control us is to invite us. So
maybe we should go.
Yes. Again, the experience with Radio Free Europe, we should go on what limit, it's for management to decide, you know. We should have, of course, ability to go there any way we want, you know, for the projects we want, or accredited journalists. But as a station, as a bureau, that would be just, at this point, I think it's just would put a lot of control on us rather than ability to say what we want to say.
Is there any time for another question?
Sure. You'll be the last. So make it a good one.
Questions about the Uzbekistan or other countries of the region relations with the United States. I would ask the reverse question. How active is United States diplomacy in Central Asia?
Well, I mean, they just held that 5+1 thing again. I'm not sure how useful. Certainly to this point, it hasn't proved entirely useful, except that the U.S. Secretary of State gets to meet with all five of the Central Asian foreign ministers at once, although we know that the Turkmen foreign minister didn't show up yesterday, for example, so this kind of shows where we're at. You know, the U.S. is disengaging from Afghanistan. I think we had a much stronger presence in the 90s, and then, of course, obviously after 9/11, but we're scaling back to a point that we haven't been at since the very, very early days of you know, right after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I think
it's part of an American habit when you get out of a conflict to lose interest in the general region entirely, Vietnam, Iraq, and we see what happened there. I don't think the Americans, they're going to have some presence in Afghanistan, but they've had such a hard time with some with the Central Asian states that I think the attitude is let's keep some irons in the fire, but there's no point in really getting heavily engaged in there. China's got the money. Russia is ultimately the one that's guaranteeing the security of the region. We had problems with Manas. We had problems with Han Abad, you know, on and on and on in Central Asia. And so I think the U.S. policy now is, like I say, stay slightly engaged with the region, but don't pay a huge amount of attention to it, because there's really it's beyond the ability of the U.S. to have a whole lot of influence in what's going on there.
The current relations with U.S. and Uzbekistan for the past several years was like this. Someone is traveling there from U.S. and Uzbekistan releasing one political prisoner after they leave. So showing that it's really good. You know, they came, they talked, they impact one political prisoner. So that's why they always kind of refill this political prisoner again, you know. So it's like this type of relations. And with Trump in the United States, it's again, if you ask him what is his views on Uzbekistan, that will be like, what is Uzbekistan, you know, kind of thing.
All right, well, thank you so much. I know now 1,000 times more than I knew about Uzbekistan. Everyone else in the room probably knows 200 times more. So it's I appreciate it very much. Thank you to everyone who's asked questions and to our panel.